from the top of the SmartWorks Tower. Nestled between the massage parlor and donut shop in beautiful downtown Red Bluff, it's the PenPals.Buzz podcast. Need a genuine connection? This is the place to learn how a pen pal can change your life. And, oh yeah, they just happen to be in prison. But Big Steve will never judge. He's open-minded, he's a little quirky, and he's ready for another adventure. So get your postage stamps, grab a pen and paper, and get comfy for 30 minutes of pen pal pleasure. Now, here's your host, Big Steve.
Yes, here he is, Big Steve, standing here in the PenPals.Buzz Prison Pen Pal podcast studio with no shirt on, because sadly, beautiful downtown Red Bluff, albeit beautiful, is also hotter than hell right now. And unfortunately, the air conditioning here only gets us about 20 degrees cooler than what it is outside. So I'm in here sweating, hot, miserable, but determined to bring you this incredible information that I have on the show today, which unfortunately I'm in a cheery mood because I have to be when I'm working in this kind of industry. I'm surrounded by despair, sadness, death, life sentences, family members losing loved ones. I can't think about that all the time because it's just so depressing. So I drink Diet Pepsi and I eat ice cream and I try to just stay positive and I try to remind myself and everybody else that works here with me, we're doing this for the greater good of society and we're doing this to make people's lives better. Even though their lives suck, royally suck right now, they're stuck in a cell. Pen pal pleasure, which is what the announcer just promoted, is maybe not what we're going to be dealing with today. So there's a little bit of false advertising, which I apologize for. But today's topic is something you just need to hear and need to understand. And it's something not a lot of people know about. And let me tell you this, it is scary as hell. I mean, this is so frightening to me. And I've been through a lot of scary stuff in my life. I've been through cancer as a young child, which I beat. Doctors said I was going to die. And then when I didn't die, the doctors said that I'd probably become, I think the term they used back in 1974 was a midget, which I didn't. I spent 11 years in a prison that they called Gladiator School. I flew in a private airplane about the size of a Toyota Camry, right through a lightning storm in Alaska. And we ran out of gas, and I got through that, but none of this stuff was anywhere remotely as scary as what we have to talk to you today about on the program. Civil commitment. Scary stuff. I knew a little bit about it before recently. Daisy, who just started working here. Daisy's amazing, by the way. If you ever call in and you need a profile created or you have questions, she's a superstar in the customer service area. She's incredible here in the office and way friendlier than I am on the phone, so I had to hire her. Treats people very well. So Daisy, unfortunately, she's not here today. I wish she were. But I talked to her a little bit about the civil commitment, and she had never heard of it. And on her lunch break, she spent some time looking up. A few of our PenPals.Buzz customers are in this civil commitment program, and a couple of them are in this place in Minnesota called St. Peter. These people never get out. Some of the guys, they think they're going in for 14 days and they never get out. I think this center, it's been open 31 years or something, maybe longer than that, 31 years. I think they've let like 10 people out in 31 years. And something like 60 or 70 people have died while they're in there. So I'm going to be going over exactly what this civil commitment is, what it entails, and why I'm saying how scary it is. You need to understand all of this. And then a little later in the show today, we've got a couple different people calling in. One is a nice man named Benjamin Alverson, who has been in the St. Peter, Minnesota civil commitment, quote unquote, treatment facility, which is a joke. I'll explain that later. He's been there for years and years, much longer than his actual sentence was. And he's going to call and just give a little background on his situation and what life is like in the civil commitment center. And then we have a guy named Jeremy Walker, who's in Idaho, and he works with some of the civil commitment people that are in the maximum security prison. All right, so I'd like to briefly explain what the civil commitment procedure is, how it works, how you end up in a place like this, and it's really horrible. But I want to set some music to kind of set the mood here. So imagine the judge sentences you to 12 years and you've done, say, 11 and a half years of those 12 and you're going to finish your sentence and you're counting each and every day. Oh, man, I got 176 days, 171 days. I got 38 days. You're counting. Your family's counting. They've set up a bedroom for you. They've done all they can to help you find a job when you get out. Let's just set the mood here. It's your last day. You're about to get out. You're excited, and you're packing your stuff up. Your family's here to pick you up. You walk out to the hallway in your street clothes. You get up to the door, and then you see one of these mental health counselors, and she says something like,
"Oh, I'm so sorry, but you're not getting out today. You're going to be sent to a civil commitment center where we're going to give you treatment."
And that's no joke. That's exactly what happens. You finish your sentence. You're done with whatever time the judge gives you. Your legal sentence is done. So you're no longer, you know, you've paid your debt to society, as they say. Right? You no longer have anything left that you owe the criminal justice system. But what happens is you get some mental health counselor who they've probably gotten a degree, because I've worked with a lot of these people myself. So I know most of them, they get these degrees from like a degree mill, right? If they don't do that, they're going to some weird online college with a name, something like Golden Gate College or whatever it is. They pay $1,000, a couple $1,000. They send a few essays in over email, or they text a few answers to some tests. And suddenly they have a master's degree and they hang it up proudly in their office that, you know, Michelle Clark has a master's degree from Golden Gate College. And suddenly she thinks she's a psychiatrist. So somebody like that looks and says, "Oh, I think Benjamin is dangerous, and we can't really trust him if he gets out, even though he did his sentence. Even though he finished his sentence, I think that we need to petition the judge and have him locked away forever because, we're scared of him. We're really scared of him." So she writes up a report. The report goes to a judge who single-handedly, now there's no jury, there's no oversight committee, there's not even a collection of judges. It's not like the Supreme Court. It's not even like an appeals court. It's one judge. They're afraid these days, judges are, to have a backbone. They're afraid to let somebody out because then they're going to get the backlash over social media and threats against their life. And so it's just easier for them. They're already making their salary. They're like, "What the hell? We already sentenced people anyway. Let's just put them into civil commitment." And then it's done. I think this inmate has a mental illness and might commit a new crime when they get out. Now, people may not appreciate this comparison, but it's just the truth, and I think it's something that we need to, you know, consider and understand a little better. Some of you, probably not many because this was a while ago, but Japanese internment camps, you probably at least read about this in your history books. 120,000 Japanese Americans were imprisoned against their will by the U.S. government during World War II. And this internment was intended to mitigate a perceived security risk posed by the Japanese Americans. There was fear. There was fear, and that's what it comes down to with them back then, and that's what it comes down to now. Essentially, the government gets scared, and they decide, "Hey, if we don't like you, if we don't understand you, if we're afraid of what you might do in the future, not what you did do, but what you might do, we're going to go ahead and find some legal way to lock you up. We'll figure it out. We'll find a loophole." Back then, it was an executive order, 9066, the order. It was issued by Franklin D. Roosevelt. And just like that, it didn't need a jury. It didn't need a trial. Just needed one person just decide to lock up 120,000 law-abiding Americans against their will. Now, history professors, perhaps even your mom or grandma, might have said about the Japanese internment camps, "Oh, that was a despicable, disgusting time in America. Luckily, that sort of thing will never happen again here." But sadly, they're just completely wrong. Completely wrong, because it's happening again. History repeats itself. Human nature doesn't change. And it's just so scary, but I want to at least use this platform to help you all understand. And in doing so, we're also going to try to help some of the guys that are stuck in this civil commitment hell to, at the very least, have someone that can write, maybe talk to them on the phone, maybe just make their life a little bit better, because I feel like even more than inmates who are actually serving time for something wrong that they did, that they were convicted of, these people didn't do anything else wrong. In fact, in a lot of cases, when we talked to Jeremy Walker in Idaho, those guys were never convicted of a crime. Those guys were just determined to be mentally ill and potentially dangerous. They haven't done anything dangerous, but maybe they will. So let's put them in Idaho. It's really crazy. They put them in a maximum security prison. They don't even try to pretend it's a treatment center. So when Benjamin Alverson signed up, sort of how this whole thing started, he's at the St. Peter, Minnesota facility, and he signed up for this inmate pen pal site that we have, penpals.buzz, but he didn't include his inmate number, his ID number. And that's one of the requirements on our application. So I wrote him back and I was like, hey, Ben, you know, we got your money and your application, but there was no inmate number. And he said, oh, that's because I'm not an inmate, so we don't use numbers. I'm a civil commitment. So I looked into this more and I was like, oh my God. And he was actually like in a surprisingly good state of mind. He's like, yeah, we're not inmates. We can wear our own clothes. We don't have to wear a jumpsuit. We get free phone calls. Mind-boggling that this sort of thing is happening. And these guys have been in there so long now, they, you know, at some point you get sick of fighting. You get sick of all the stress of like, this can't be right. This can't be legal. How can they do this? But at some point, you just get so tired of fighting, you know? It's like the fight or flight or whatever. You can fight for so long, eventually you just succumb to your fate. And it's really, really sad because a lot of these guys are talented. Ben himself is a great artist. He actually has some art at local exhibits, but he's not allowed to go to the exhibits because he's stuck in this, what they call a treatment center, which is really just a prison. And obviously their treatment isn't so good because they've had hundreds of people in there and they've let out 9 in 30 years. They let out like one person every 4 years. So I don't think the treatment's working very well, is it? If the point is to get people treatment to get them better, I don't think that's I don't think they're doing so well. If they were more like a Kevorkian and their plan was to kill people, to have people die, then they're a lot more successful. That's scary. If you go to a therapist and he's more successful at causing you to die while you're in his treatment facility than to actually get help, that's frightening. I just had to share this with you. So we're going to talk to Benjamin a little bit later on in the show. I think I'm more angry about it than he is, which is remarkable. I think he's been in there 21 years, and I think he had like a 7-year original sentence. And I mean, he's younger than, I think he's in his 40s now. Just really, really sad. So you ask yourself, how can they get away with this, right? Because anyone with even a basic legal background, even a high school history class if you've taken, you've likely heard of the term double jeopardy. And they spit these terms out as if, oh, this is the law and there's no double jeopardy in America. But it's complete bullshit because there is, and it's happening right here. And, you know, you hear all the time, oh, they can't search your car without a warrant. But they do, right? They can't entrap you. Oh, yeah, they can. They do. So whatever they teach you in history class and in law 101, it's complete bullshit. And until you've been through the system, you don't realize that. So double jeopardy, it's a principle that basically says you can't be charged twice for the same crime. And it also says you can't be sentenced twice for the same crime, kind of under the same criteria. So if a man or woman is sentenced by a judge to serve, say, 8 years, he finishes his 8-year sentence, he should pack his stuff up and go home. But they say, oh, au contraire, sir, you're not going home. You're now going to the mental health treatment facility based on the civil commitment law in your state, which they have 20 of the 50 states have these laws. So one thing to do is figure out the other 30 states. Don't go to these. Definitely don't go to Minnesota, I can tell you that. And don't go to California either. So these corrupt courts, they've been sued a lot because this is completely double jeopardy. And it's a despicable practice, in my opinion. And they claim that, oh, no, it's legal because it's not punishment. It's not punishment. No, it's simply mental health treatment. We're just helping them because they've already been punished. We can't punish them more. No, we're just going to give them treatment in a treatment facility. where, by the way, they get like 1 or 2 hours of treatment a week. And as I said, it doesn't really help, does it? There was a fascinating article in 2021 by Jacob Solem with Reason Magazine, great libertarian magazine. If you don't subscribe to it and you can get it, you know, in print, I would suggest ordering that for inmates you know and love to have it sent to their cell, or you can read it yourself online. But the title of the article is, I mean, he just summed it up so well. Civil commitment of sex offenders pretends prisoners are patients. I mean, that's all there is to it. They pretend that prisoners are patients. And they even went so far to tell some of these guys, do not ever call your living quarters a cell. You if they called it a cell, they'd get in trouble because then that could be considered, oh, maybe they are a prisoner. Oh, no. No, you must call it a room. And it's not your cellmate, it's your roommate. And wear normal clothes. You're not wearing prison clothes. And I don't know who they're fooling. I don't know where the wool is and where the eyes are. But anyone with half of a brain cell knows that this is just a bunch of crap. Just a bunch of crap. This isn't treatment. They're not in there getting treatment. It's too expensive, for one. They're in there being locked away. And then when you call, let me see if I can. I'm going to try to call right now because I want you to hear, when you call this place, you can leave a 15-second voicemail for any of the residents in the treatment center. And I want you to hear this guy's voice when you call the voicemail. I'll try to do it. It's like, hi, you've called the St. Peter Mental Health Treatment Facility. And if you have a client that you'd like to leave a message for, complete BS. They can just say, hey, you've called this effed up place where we keep hundreds and hundreds of people against their will. All right, we got him on the phone here.
You have reached the message center for clients in the secure treatment facility at St. Peter, Minnesota. Messages left for individual clients are monitored by our security staff and cannot exceed 15 seconds in length. If you know the access code for the client for which you wish to leave a message, dial it now. To access the mailbox of a client whose access code you do not know, please press 0 for the client directory.
Notice they said the word client 4 times. They didn't say inmate. They didn't say guy that we're keeping against his will for the rest of his life. No, he's a client. And they don't say it once. You've reached the message center for clients. If you know your client's number, if you want to leave another message for a different client and this client and that client, they say client as many times as they can because somehow that makes it okay. Hello, it's the penpals.buzz podcast.
Hello, you have a prepaid call from
Jeremy Walker,
an inmate at the host state correctional center.
Hello,
Jeremy.
Steve,
thanks so much for, man, look at, you got a round of applause already. That's crazy. Your job, that was one of the most interesting things when you signed up and we were learning more about you. You're actually, you work with the civil commitment people at the maximum security prison. Is that right, in Idaho?
Yes, I do. I spend most of the day at the civil commitment. There's 64 of them in max. And I monitor their behavior. I am supposed to check in their mental health and see how they are, you know, say hi and see how they're doing, making sure they're okay and not depressed. And then there's some that I spend all day with, you know, sometimes play tic-tac-toe. I've gotten to know the individuals extremely well.
I mean, it sounds like their life in there is worse than even the guys that are locked up for a crime they committed. I mean,
yeah, so they are on 22-2, technically. That means 22 hours a day, locked down in your cell with 2 hours out.
Wow.
They are handcuffed to and from the shower, and then they're not allowed to have, you know, contact with regular mates at all besides us. We're called companions. That's our job.
What I was reading is this goes against the guidelines by the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It goes against recommendations from the American Psychiatric Association, federal courts. The United Nations says don't put them into prisons, but somehow Idaho has a way to do it anyway.
I got to say, the housing conditions there for civil commitments is just insane. There's no janitor on this here. Unless I volunteer to go clean it, it doesn't get cleaned. There's bugs crawling around all over. You're not allowed to have regular clothes. No electronics in their house or in their cell. It's just insane. There's brown and black water that comes out of the faucets for, you know, five seconds.
If they want to, can they go check out, like, some cleaning supplies or anything if they want to, like, clean their toilets?
Nope. There is absolutely none of that. Like, by the trash cans, they have, like, seven trash cans that are just full of trash that, you know, there's bugs and stuff crawling all over it. And literally, I had to beg for 3 weeks to go and clean the tier because they don't have a janitor for that tier because no one's allowed to be around civil commitments.
I mean, when you get isolated from the whole world and then that's under the guise of this is treatment for you, which obviously it's not.
No, the treatment, I'm actually, you know, I have some firsthand knowledge about the treatment, and it is insane.
I would imagine they, they go in and they have like a few hours of a class or something every day, and they go over their homework, and they work toward completing some program so that they can get out. Is that what happens?
That's some wishful, Steve. That's not what happens at all. This is exactly what happens. Between about 7:30 in the morning, about 10, they wait for a clinician to come in, and the clinician has his piece of paper, and they go over, you know, their thoughts throughout the day, if they're depressed, or, you know, that's their whole treatment plan. One clinician talking to them for maybe 10 minutes a day. There's no actual help.
Have some of those guys been in there, like, for years?
I've seen someone that's in there for about 8 years right now. Just think about that. Never knowing if you're going to get out or when. When you're, you know, doing time for a sentence, you know when your, you know, time is up for you to get out. These civil commitments, it's just based on the clinician and how they feel your mindset is. But they don't know you enough to be able to know when you're, you know, speaking of anger or passion or if you're depressed or happy or anything. You know, they talk to you for 15 minutes a day and they go about their lives. And, I mean, the clinicians, they want to get off of that chair as soon as possible. They're not trying to sit there and spend, you know, a couple hours on that chair going from, you know, door to door. Like, if you're sleeping, and they always do this in the morning, if they're sleeping, they'll knock on the window once and then leave and then just mark you down as a refusal.
As a refusal, so then you get, like, points against you for that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so then you're doing more time. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
It goes in front of all, like, the head people as you're refusing treatment if you sleep through it.
Do they treat them nicely, at least? Are they kind and respectful, or are they more like a CO where they're just going to yell at them? And
there's a few that are nice and respectful, and I think that generally want to help. And then there's the others that are just there for a paycheck that treat them almost like they're dogs. I've seen some civil commitments in there really crying, asking for help, asking what they need to do. And the clinician would respond saying something to the effect of your behavior put you. Like, how is that helpful? You can take the most normal person, you know, ever, just any person in society, and put them in this same situation. And I'm willing to bet it would be years before they ever saw the daylight again.
Yeah, that's so
just because of how it's set up. It's not set up for success.
So tell me about some of the guys that are in there.
One that I've gotten to know really well, I consider him a friend. His name is Nibby. Naturally, he's going to struggle with a little bit of depression or, you know, something because of his situation. But he doesn't freak out. He doesn't do any bad behavior. He hasn't.
That's the thing. They tell you to play by these rules. And if you just keep playing by the rules, they give you this false hope that you're going to be released. The guys that really, really, really want to get out, they're going to do everything they can to try to, okay, I'll do everything they say, and then good things are going to happen. And then it gets to that point, and then 8 years later, there they are.
Nibby, actually, he went in front for a review to try and get out, and he got denied, saying that he wasn't continuously taking his meds for long enough, and that's the reason why they kept him. But he was taking his meds for like 5 or 6 months straight, every day. I'm the one that marked everything down. And they said that wasn't good enough. They're not even trained to deal with anything.
Yeah.
My biggest problem is that they want to say that inmates are the criminals and we're the ones that need reform and change, and yet they are torturing individuals on a daily basis and they feel no regret. Most of them have these cookie-cutter degrees, and they don't do anything. I see them more than the civil commitments, and I barely see them.
Tell us about this Jensen guy.
So Jensen was convicted of murder in 2006. He was sent to prison, and in 2016, his case was overturned. He never committed the crime. He had familial DNA.
Okay.
And at that time, they could only pinpoint him. It was actually his brother-in-law that did it.
Okay.
And because of his mental health issues and the meds he takes, they won't let him out. He has been incarcerated since 2006.
So he wins. And he basically wins his appeal. Then he's probably like excited, like, I'm getting the hell out of here. And is that kind of how it is? And he gets to the door and they're like, nope.
Well, so they told him 3 days, like he thought he was getting out, and then his stuff went to court, and it got overturned, and when he got back, the clinicians said that he was seeking a court order for him to be civilly committed. And then that happened like 48 hours later, so he never got out. These individuals aren't allowed to order commissary. And I will bring them coffee and, like, slide it out of their door.
Yeah.
And I'm not allowed to do that, but I could care less.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when just for everyone who's listening, just imagine you being in some sort of cell for, you know, 5 days, and all you want in life is a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's unreal.
That's a pick-me-up. Yeah. Like, you know, so any little things that we can do to help somebody. Individuals.
Don't name names, but have there been staff members that are kind of aligned with your thinking on this?
There's definitely ones that have so much empathy for the individuals there. One that I work directly with, I wish I could give out his name, but I can't. He feels the same way about me, and he's trying to change it, but there's no power. You know, the COs have no power over these guys. With regular inmates, if we're doing something, they can spray us, they, you know, can throw us down to the ground or do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They can't touch them. It has to be clinicians. And these clinicians don't know what they're doing. They just don't. They have this drug out there that's called Halidol.
Okay.
And it's designed for mental health disorders. They force syringe after syringe after syringe of Halidol in these individuals, and they'll like sleep for like 3 days straight. They're so drugged up, they're not able to comprehend anything.
Yeah.
And that's the treatment that they offer. They're not volunteering to get these shots.
Yeah.
They will hold them down and inject.
I guess it's silly to even ask this, but what about rec? Do they get any outdoor time, or are they just in the cage?
Oh, you're going to love this. So their rec consists of everything around day room.
In the day room?
Yeah, they don't get to go outside of it. They don't get to breathe fresh air. That's literally their rec, is they're handcuffed from one tier, and then they walk to the other one. They unhandcuff them and let them walk around. In the background somewhere, they have like a TV playing that usually has like SpongeBob SquarePants playing on it or something like that. That's not recreation.
Let's just briefly go over the things that normal inmates that are in there that committed a crime and either got convicted or pled guilty. So they get things like commissary. Is it still like I don't know what the limit is. It used to be $80 a week in commissary to buy, you know, honey buns and beans and tortillas and whatever they want. Shampoo, shaving cream. So they get none of that.
Nope.
They get,
no.
They don't
they
get
are,
coffee.
They're not.
They can't get coffee? Can they get...
Nope.
And then what about... So they can't buy their own TVs?
No, they're not allowed to have any electronics in their house at all. In their cell. They are not allowed any personal clothing. You know, shoes, shorts, you know, anything that a regular inmate can buy, they don't have. They have a... They start off with, like, this green-looking smock thing that looks like a blanket. And then they end up with a yellow jumpsuit. That's it. They're not allowed to have bowls, you know, cups, spoons, nothing like that you know, any general population inmates allowed to have. Oh. All their hygiene is provided by the state, and then you get those little bars of soap that don't do anything, and then... Yeah.
And I know how that toothpaste tastes like ass, that free state toothpaste.
You know, you might as well not brush your teeth at that point.
That's horrible. I don't know.
They don't get shampoo.
I don't know how they can deal with that. Have there been suicides in there at all since you've been there?
Yes, there's been suicides. There's been a lot of suicide attempts. And I don't blame...
Yeah, I don't
anyone
either.
Who's like, I don't condone suicide at all, but I understand it with the situation they are in. You know, you're better off committing a crime and coming to prison. You get treated better.
I would guess, I don't know this for sure, but I know like Russia is pretty bad, but I would guess even people that are taken to a Russian prison and held captive, you know what I mean? Like Brittany Griner back in the day. I bet they're even treated better than we treat our own people here that didn't even get convicted of anything.
You stole my line, Steve. How dare you? Brittany Griner got treated way better than any civil commitment gets treated here. I guarantee she had a cup of coffee in her state.
These guys have done nothing other than making some clinician afraid that, oh, maybe they're going to reoffend or maybe they're going to be dangerous and... We're scared, so let's just put them away.
And on that, I know civil commitments in here that have not committed a crime, that are here solely based on the fact that they were deemed too dangerous for a mental health facility like Blackfoot's Health. So they've never committed a crime in their life, and they're doing prison time.
I don't know.
Being treated worse than prisoners. Like, just imagine that.
I can't imagine. I don't know how they get away with it.
The famous saying is, come on vacation, leave on probation. That's Idaho.
That's a little bit too true.
That's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I have been clean and sober for the last 3 years of my life, and I haven't gotten out. I haven't had one DOR, no negative behavior at all.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working with individuals, trying to help them change their lives and mine, and they still won't let me out. I've got about 2.5 years to top.
Okay.
But I see the parole board in 6 months. We'll see how that goes. I mean, I haven't done anything wrong in so long, but I can't predict on how they're going to feel on that particular day. You know, like whatever happened to it being, hey, your behavior's good, your behavior's been, you know, good for this long, let's give you a chance when you get out. It's not like that in Idaho. But luckily for you, whenever you want to do a show on any type of sentence or anything, I'm your guy because I'm in prison and I have nothing better to do with my life.
Hey, before you go, can you give a little shout-out for your... You said Nibby is the guy that... one of the nicer guys in there. Maybe we can get somebody to J-pay him or something, help keep him company.
Nibby is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet in your life. He has no ill feelings towards anybody. Even with everything that he's going through here, he still maintains a positive attitude.
So if you go to jpay.com and then you just enter Idaho for the state and enter 129614, you're going to see his name on there, and then you can click on the thing and start writing to him.
I would highly recommend just writing to him and getting to know him for who he is and not who anybody says he is. He is a very good guy. And he just needs a little bit of hope in his life. Give him something to look forward to because he needs it. I would like to end this just saying I wanted to give a little shout-out to Tina Wickman. She is my girlfriend, and she is amazing.
I
met her through penpal.buzz.
Can we get her some applause here? Let's get her. Yeah. I like to use that button. I just got this new button in. Yeah. Amazing. Tina from Florida.
She will definitely be listening.
Are you guys going to meet when you get out? I hope so.
I mean, we're not talking about marriage just yet, but I'll probably end up marrying this girl. She is absolutely everything I am looking for in a partner. And I like it because, you know, I'm a convict, you know, ex-drug addict.
1 minute remaining.
And she will hold me accountable if she's not afraid to. And I love that.
I love hearing that because I feel like what we're doing is just helping so many people in so many different ways.
If you ever want to try writing a prisoner, please go through this website because it will change your life, I promise.
Jeremy Walker, everybody, thanks again for calling in today. If anybody wants to write to him or learn some more about some of the stuff he talked about today on the show, you can write to Jeremy Walker, which is J-E-R-M-Y, Walker, W-A-L-K-E-R, number 98806. Then you write ISCC, P.O. Box 70010, Boise, Idaho, 83707. You can also get onto JPay and search for number 98806 in Idaho. And you can learn a lot more straight from the man himself, Jeremy Walker. And now, looks like Benjamin Alverson is on hold. We're going to patch ourselves through to him, calling directly from the, they call it a treatment facility. That's what, but why are there bars on the window? We'll find that out. What is he, on line 6? Benjamin.
To accept this free call, press 0. To refute, calls are subject to monitoring and may be recorded. Your call will now be connected. Thank you for using GTL.
Hey, Art.
Here I am, and welcome to the show, buddy. We're excited to hear your story today.
I'm anxious to kind of educate as best I can, as you know, far as the situation goes here. And I know you've got some questions, looking for a few more details.
So we've been talking about this topic of the civil commitment, and instead of just what we hear in the news or what we read about, we can actually hear it straight from the mouth of somebody that's been living in that environment for a while. And it was funny because when you first signed up for penpals.buzz, if I remember, we wrote you back and we're like, hey, we didn't get your inmate number, and you said, well, because that's not, I'm not an inmate.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's what kind of led us down this path. And if you want, go ahead and expand on that and what the differences are between inmates and civil commitments.
Well, sure. Well, let me start with there's a couple of different variations of civil commitment in multiple different states. There's only about 21 states, including Minnesota, that have civil commitment of some fashion here. I know that California does. They also have a sex offender civil commitment, and that's, you know, runs its own rules and that kind of thing.
Okay.
Minnesota is another one that has a separate category for also sex offenders versus people who are typical civil commitments who, and the difference is essentially that the laws, the way they are, at least in this state, you have to have like an utter lack of control to control your impulses. Back in 1939, the Minnesota Supreme Court narrowed the law to save constitutionality. That kind of created the whole ball of wax that said, okay, if somebody's kind of off their meds and acting a little outside their zone, so to speak, kind of off the chain, you know, let's go ahead and take them in, get them evaluated, assessed, and that kind of thing. And then, of course, in the 80s and 90s, the second generation of civil commitment laws rose out of a pretty documented moral panic, kind of completely untethered from evidence about offenders, you know, statistical evidence. So in 94, the Supreme Court reversed the commitment of a pretty serious offender on the grounds that there was no proof of an utter lack of control. And then so they had the legislature had a meeting for like about an hour and a half and then created a secondary version, a less restrictive version of the civil commitment law, which basically said, now it's no longer a psychopathic personality that you need, but you have to have an utter lack of control to control your sexual impulses. And the catch to that is that people who, there's a fellow, pretty famous guy, for more recently, I should say, is a guy named, last name of Rodriguez. He was a guy who got out of prison, went over to South Dakota or kidnapped a South Dakota gal that was in college. And, I'll let your listeners go ahead and look that up if they're curious. But that basically started a knee-jerk reaction to civilly commit pretty much anybody who had a sexual case. As a result of that, even people who had already done their time, and this is the catch, this is the big piece of it here that differs Minnesota from many other states, is that you don't have to have proof of harm to civilly commit somebody. And so as a result of that, there was a number of guys that were doing their time on the streets, got roped in, evaluated, assessed, and then kind of the railroad kind of took its own way to expand a program that originally had about 230, 250 people to over 700 in just a couple of years.
That's just in the facility you're in? That's not all of Minnesota? That's just St. Peter?
Correct. So I don't even know how much the original civil commitment program has, but they're separate from us. There were two separate programs. But the way that everything is handled is pretty much for the secondary purposes is stemmed off of the way it was originally written out.
Okay.
And so that requires, as it stands now, a fairly lengthy time frame of filing to get evaluated and then going to a panel that says, yes or no, we support you, we don't support you, and then which doesn't have any teeth at all, just recommends. And then you go to the Commitment Appeals Panel, which then is a standard set of judges, retired judges, that say, yes, we agree with, and you're free to move on. Now, there's the guys that are inside the perimeter. There is, after you go through that process, which can take about up to 3 years at this point, then you go to what's called Community Preparation Services, or CPS, and that is outside the fence, but still on the campus of the hospital. And from that point, you go ahead and file again, which takes another 3 years, and then you get to be on provisional discharge. Now, provisional discharge is in the community, but you're on GPS monitoring. It's essentially parole, if you will, or
okay.
A supervised release type of thing.
What percent, Ben, would you say are on that monitor that actually, out of the, 800 that are there, how many can actually go out and do their thing with the monitor on?
Well, as it stands right now, there's only 21 people that were committed to the program that have been fully discharged.
Okay.
Unfortunately, over 90 people have died versus the 21 that have been fully discharged.
And you mentioned that people were in the perimeter of, you called it the hospital, and I know when I took the call here a second ago, they keep referring to you as a client because I know they can't refer to you as an inmate or somebody being punished because then that would go against the laws. But when you use the word hospital, and I know that they've directed some people in other places, I don't know about yours, not to call the room cells, to make sure they call them rooms, and make sure you call it my roommate, not my cellmate, because then that could potentially get them in trouble. But what, like, describe where you are. Like, does it feel like a hospital, or does it feel like a jail cell?
We are living in buildings that are more or less dormitories.
Okay.
And, yes, we do have our roommate. We do have the prison-style gray bins that slide under the bed for, a property. But we also have wooden cabinets and a wardrobe, things of that nature, that are in the room as well. So it's more of a dormitory-style living. The catch is that there's still bars on the windows. There's chain-link fence that has razor wire on top of it. So we have controlled movement. A lot of it still is prison-like. And as a matter of fact, we some years ago, we actually took it to court, to federal court, literally made a federal case out of it and said, look, all of these environmental ingredients, if you will, are prison-like, and even brought up a couple of cases that were presented to the courts before ours to say, hey, look, if these ingredients apply, then we should get credit for jail time or at least be considered in jail or incarceration. Initially, the court agreed. Eventually, the state appealed, of course, and it was blown back. However, as a process of attacking that aspect of it, that's when things started changing. It got a lot of news press. The state paper wrote up about Minneapolis Star Tribune. They wrote up a few articles on it. They sent some pretty savvy reporters to kind of do some in-depth conversations with some people, some interviews, and then wrote up a multi-page, multi-day articles on it.
I've been in this circle for a while, and I knew just very minimal about the whole situation with the civil commitments. Daisy, who's here across the room from me, didn't know really anything about it. And it's like most people I talk to, they don't even know what I'm talking about. And when I tell them, these guys already did their complete sentence and then they don't let them out, they think I'm kidding. So I'm glad that there's these reporters, and that's what we're just trying to spread some more awareness to the world. So that
my crime happened back in 98. That was a long time ago. And I originally got, 23 months on that. And then, of course, that turned out to an additional total of 6 years, because Minnesota has a 5-year conditional release that they add on top of the time that you do. And then shortly after that expired, they addressed the civil commitment process, and I've been here ever since.
So you got sentenced to 23 months in 1998, and now you're sitting in St. Peter, and it's not 23 months later, but it's 26 years later. I mean, that's the reality.
Give or take, yeah.
That's incredible.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yes. Yeah. The interesting thing is that I think is an educational piece of it, too, is that there have been multiple reports. There's a Department of Justice study back in 2019 that tracked recidivism rates of persons released from state prisons, and people who were people who were convicted of sexual crimes were 92.3% were not arrested, were successful, and were not rearrested for a new offense during a 9-year follow-up, which came to about, 7% recidivism rate? So those studies for like, you know, low risk, high risk offenders and things of that nature, next to, I think, murders, people who have been convicted of sexual offenses, and I'm not saying it's a good thing at all in any way, shape, or form. I'm not trying to say that, you know, what I've done is I'm not sorry for it, or I haven't, you know, done my penance and some treatment for it, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. But it's a low, low rate. I mean, I know it's historically low and lower than domestic violence, lower than robbery, lower than drugs, lower than almost anything. And yet those aren't the guys they're keeping for, you know, fear that they're going to reoffend. And even murderers they're not putting in there, are they?
No, they're not. There are some individuals in here that they're a little mixed with regards to some of their own. Let's say they're put on the scale, you know, mentally. They've got some, you know, challenges and whatnot, which is fine. But there's also have established, you know, a process for getting them into group homes and things of that nature when they do get to that point of, you know, being discharged out into the community. That's happening, but it didn't for the longest time.
Yeah.
And even myself, I made it all the way out to provisional discharge. Was out there for about a year in 21. And then that was kind of post sort of COVID.
Right.
So it was really challenging for me to, you know, connect with people in the community and things of that nature, because there was still some, you know, fear of contact and, you know, all this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah. Hey, I don't want to interrupt you here. I know we've only got like a minute left on you. You get 15-minute calls there, right? So I just wanted to make sure.
That's correct. Yep.
I want to get your information out there. So if people want to write to you, or they want to learn more, or they want to be your pen pal, your friend, whatever.
Area code 507-484-9930, extension 53824. You can leave a 15-second voicemail message on there. We've got the caller ID. I can bring you back. I never call collect. We got free calls. In addition to, you know, for my own story, what I've done for myself since I've been inside the facility, I've kind of practiced and put a lot more energy in.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Put a lot more creativity in my art. I paint, I draw, I sketch. I'm teaching myself guitar. I've done a little bit of higher education since I've been in the system. So,
and your art's amazing. People can see your art on the on pinpals.buzz. You have some samples of that, which is awesome stuff.
I do, and I will be rotating them in the near future as time goes on. So, please take a look at them, and I will send a personally designed card to anybody who writes me.
You're great. Thank you so much. I hope we can talk again soon, because this is really, really interesting stuff, and I appreciate you sharing your story with everybody.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
And we appreciate you calling in, Ben, and, you know, dang it, I wish we had time to – I wanted to have him read his profile for everybody, because – this is one of the more entertaining and interesting profiles. I'm just going to go ahead and let me give you his address here, because we got his voicemail number. His address, Ben Alverson, 100 Freeman Drive, F-R-E-E-M-A-N Drive, St. Peter, Minnesota, 56082. And he left you his voicemail number. But you got to be fast on that, because they only give you 15 seconds. So say what you got to say in a hurry. All right. Before we wrap up here, I know we ran like way, way, way over. It's supposed to be 30 minutes, and it's been like 48 minutes or so at this point. But one final note that I think is necessary to mention about this whole situation of the civil commitments is that, I mean, the evidence here is undeniable. African Americans and those in the LGBTQ community get civilly committed at a substantially higher rate than white people. And then the question would be, why would that be? Why would that happen? The answer is relatively simple. The assessment tests that these prison clinicians use, they're tests with names like Static 99 and another one that's interestingly named the Stable test. The problem with these tests, they're used to assess your risk, how high of a risk you are. And the questions on the test ask things such as, have you been married for at least 2 years? And if you say no, you get extra points on the assessment scale, which means you're at a higher risk because you haven't been married for 2 years. Another question they ask is, do you have friends or family who have ever been incarcerated? And again, if you answer yes to that, you're automatically considered to be a higher risk of reoffending, because they claim you have poor social influences, and that's one of the factors in criminology, in predicting whether or not a person will commit a new crime. Now, the problem here that may jump out at you, and if it doesn't, gay men and women in many states, they can't get married. And even in the states where they can get married, they're less likely to live together in a romantic relationship because of other people's views, or they're afraid of being outed. So for that reason alone, anyone in the LGBTQ community is going to be in a higher risk category than a straight white male would be who answered all the other questions the same. And the same with blacks and Hispanics, because they're historically far more likely to have friends or family in prison than white people are. And so they get marked against them, not because of what they did or didn't do, just because these people in Canada created this test called Static 99, and they concluded with almost no published data that people who have family in prison are at a high risk to reoffend. And that's all it takes. The clinician just checks the box, and then boom, you're there with Ben, sitting there in St. Peter with bars on the window, telling people you're not an inmate. Terrible. These assessments don't have anything to do with the actual person. Nothing at all to do with anything a person did. All they like to do is fit you into a box of other groups of people from decades ago who may or may not have had similar characteristics, may or may not have lived with a romantic partner for at least 2 years. All right, in closing today, I'd just like to revisit for a moment that article I talked about a little earlier from Reason Magazine. It's a great article, and in it, Virginia State Senator Joe Morrissey stated, quote, "We don't sentence people because of what they might do," close quote. We don't sentence people because of what they might do, which is exactly what we've been doing. Reliving the movie Minority Report. I think he might commit a crime next year. I think she might do something bad tomorrow. So let's just lock them both up and then we'll prevent those crimes from happening. That's what's going on. And sadly, Joe Morrissey was on our team. He was one of the good guys, and he fought and fought and fought to try to abolish similar programs that they have in Virginia that are just like the ones in Minnesota. But he lost that fight. It's too bad. I guess he was thinking that the judges and the court system would actually be fair and honest and just and follow the laws. What was he thinking? Just a fantasy, that's all.
It's lockdown time for Big Steve. But he'll be back Monday with another edition of the PenPals.Buzz podcast. To be a guest on our show, email podcast@penpals.buzz or call 888-2-PENPAL. PenPals.Buzz is a division of Snaptura Inmate Services.